Talk given Saturday, 11th March, 1972. It is a bitterly cold day today. Winds which hurt one as they blow against one. And we naturally yearn for better conditions, as we say. If the sky is overcast, we forget that beyond the clouds there's the sun shining. And if we remember that, we remember it in order to console ourselves for what is actually present. In other words, under different conditions, we are longing for something other than what actually is present. It is the tyranny of the various elements. That is how we put it. That it is the tyranny of the elements. But is it actually the tyranny of the elements? You see, we are attached to this, that, or the other. And the attachment is, of course, born of our natural ability or inability to withstand certain conditions around us. There are those who like extreme cold. They thoroughly enjoy it. They go about with an open shirt when you've got a bitter northeaster blowing at you, and that sort of thing. Others like different conditions. But we are attached to the elements. I'm using the word elements in the sense in which the word has been used through centuries: earth, air, fire, water. It's more convenient than talking of sodium, potassium, tin, aluminium, and all the rest of it. And it is this attachment to some conditions, this aversion to other conditions, which is born of our attachment and aversion. It is born of the nature of our own constitution. But what does this mean essentially? It means at root that we are conscious of the world in which we live predominantly, if not entirely, in analytical terms. Is there earth, air, fire, water? In ultimate fact, in the sense in which we mean earth, air, fire, water? Or is it our mode of awareness of that which is? This is the important question. If our mode of awareness was that of an awareness of totality, a totality in which all that we talk of separately was completely integrated into a whole, then would we have attachment and aversion to analytical particulars? This is the point. At root, it is our mode of consciousness which makes the difference. our present mode of consciousness. And we must also bear in mind that our present mode of consciousness has come into being and is what it is because we have evolved out of a primitive condition. Our primordial ancestor was conscious only in this extremely limited way. And we still are conscious in that way. Although the ages, with their development and progress and so on, have produced modifications. But those modifications have not helped us to become free of this conflicting duality within us, this duality of attachment and aversion. What is our task? One of our tasks, amongst other tasks, then, to see into the truth of this fact that we function in terms of attachment and aversion. Pleasure and pain, that is to say, pleasant sensations physically and painful sensations, will always be there so long as we are constituted as we are constituted. If we have a brain and a nervous system, well, this particular organism then must of necessity have an efficiently functioning nervous mechanism which will register accurately those sensations which are pleasant and those which are unpleasant. This is for the sake of our own safety, our well-being, bodily safety, well-being and survival. That is true. But the psychical counterpart is where we have got caught. The psychical counterpart of pleasant sensations is what we call joy or happiness or pleasure and so forth. And of unpleasant sensations, painful sensations, the psychical counterpart is dislike, aversion, fear, and so on. This psychical aspect is the one that is the root of our difficulties and troubles. The joy, sorrow, complementaries. This joy-sorrow aspect is one to which we are in bondage simply because we have not seen, really seen, understood, and functioned in terms of totality, in terms of the wholeness of things. If we see it merely intellectually, as the ordinary man of the world says, take it philosophically, then his acceptance is the acceptance of mere resignation, not of understanding. Not of true understanding. His rejection of what he considers evil or bad, etc., is not a true ethic, a true morality within himself, but an imposed morality. This is an ought to be done. This is how the gentleman, the lady, the intelligent person looks upon such and such a matter. And therefore, no, it's not done, and you reject it. But this sort of rejection merely means that inside the psyche there is an unconscious antagonistic force accumulating, which will someday burst out when we are caught napping. It happens always. It can never be avoided. So one begins to see the fundamental importance of a seeing which brings real understanding, a seeing of the truth of the situation and of our own functioning with such intensity that the psyche always remains poised, whatever the external physical condition of painfulness or pleasantness is present. And this is by no means easy. Our attachment to the different elements and the particular conditions which obtain when such and such elements are present in the immediate now we are in bondage to them out of ignorance, not intellectual ignorance, but this deeper ignorance, which is the ignorance of the right sort of awareness, the right sort of vision of the truth of things. This is where our difficulty comes. I asked the question earlier on, are the elements separate? Are they different? We don't know. They may be absolutely different in themselves. What are these elements as far as our present scientific knowledge tells us? They are particular manifestations to our type of consciousness, particular manifestations of energy. How energy manifests itself. There must of necessity be variety in the manifestation, otherwise we would not see differences at all. There is an actual variety present, because our consciousness is our consciousness, whatever it is at the moment. It registers differently. Therefore, if it registers differently, it is most probable that there are differences in the modes of manifestation. In the modes of manifestation, remember. But fundamentally, it is just so much energy at play. It is the play of universal energy. And we are conscious of this play, not dispassionately, but in a spoilt manner. Spoilt by what we desire and what we do not desire. This is quite a tricky and a difficult problem. If we were aware of any object, say a solid, whether it be a solid or a liquid or a gas, if we were aware of phenomena like heat, pressure, atmospheric pressures, and so on, if we were aware of those things in terms of their fundamentals, how do you think we would react to them? Heat might not, fire might not burn us, water might not wet us, cold might not make us shiver, and so on. If I am a clod of earth, does it matter to me whether the temperature is minus 200 or whether it is 4,000 degrees centigrade? If it's very much more than that, I'll melt off, of course. But what difference would it make to me? None at all. So you see, the point I'm trying to get at, and as you observe with some considerable difficulty, is that what we are in ourselves is what makes the greatest difference. Not the external thing. Now we know that through our own lives, don't we? In our own lives, under given certain circumstances which are a source of elation for us, we'll go through a bitter cold wind at 60 miles an hour blowing against us without turning a hair. We shall be so full of elation because we've had some very good news, as we say, that all's well with the world and everything's wonderful. And if we are in a state which is the very reverse of elation, then wonderful sunshine and bird singing and beauty around us would be completely unnoticed by us because we are in the miserable state. See, this is a fact of our lives, isn't it? And what is so important, really, is what we ourselves are. Our interplay with the elements at root depends on us, not on the elements. Our being, our growth, our fulfillment, everything depends upon our approach and understanding, not upon the situation. The situation may be pleasurable, it may be favorable, or it may be the very opposite. But if we are sensible in the true sense of the word, then we would learn from any and every situation. And what does learning mean in the religious context? There is nothing which is acquired, nothing which is attained, achieved, nothing at all by me, the person, the individual. There is nothing for me to grasp at, nothing for me to aim at. You see, this religious context is a terrible context in a way. Why do you think people through the ages have always talked of the awesomeness, the awful majesty of God? What is there so awful and terrible? What is there that makes one shut one's eyes in the presence of the Absolute, so to say? Through the ages this has been the case, has it not? Because there is nothing for me. There is no me or I in the presence of totality, in the presence of the Absolute. And the Absolute as the real is the all. As an intellectual statement, it means nothing to me in my daily life and conduct. But as a realization in inner consciousness, it means that this person has completely purified himself of all egoism, of all self-centeredness, all self-orientedness. And why is self-centeredness and self-orientedness evil? Because this misconception, which we call myself or himself or yourself, this misconception is the obstruction to the light of the transcendent. The reality of the psychophysical organism is there, of course. And it is a separate organism from any other psychophysical organism. John is different from Bill. And Mary is different from Anne. Perfectly true. But when the isolative, separative self-consciousness is predominantly powerful in each one and keeps that person separated, then the energies, the life energies through that person work in disharmony with it, in contradiction to the Absolute. So there is conflict. And it is I who suffer and I who do not learn. The separate I. Only the separate I suffers because of the misperception, the misconception, and therefore the misdirected life energies. The totality cannot suffer. And yet it is none but the totality which really suffers. Somehow, let go. Only you can do this, and there is no how to it. If somebody is gripping something very tightly, and something which hurts his hand, and you tell him, let go, and he says, well, how do I let go? You say, unclasp. And how do I unclasp? He goes on asking this question. He's absolutely caught in some mania, isn't he? You let go. The organism can do it. Unless, of course, it's a diseased organism, something which prevents him, some external force or internal disorder which renders him incapable of unclasping. But in the ordinary way, we are not like that. We can let go. Let go. Do not grasp. Then it is possible to learn. And the learning consists in the religious context in the flowering of awareness of totality. But you see, all the time, the elements stand in the way. Fire, air, earth, water, objects, things, creatures, situations, work, and our own actual living being, which is made up of the elements, it always stands in the way. This, which is the appearance of reality, casts a shadow. Reality is empty. Wholly empty. It's transparent. Altogether. It being reality, it being the source of all power, throws up appearances, throws up forms. Totality comes to self-consciousness in each of us. And our task is so to learn and understand that we become free of the isolativeness we set up through self-consciousness. These are my interests. This is my property. This is my work. And all the rest of it. It is. But the moment the isolative element enters, then the evil in the situation has entered the situation. As long as there is no isolativeness, but I see whatever there is in my life, my work, my house, my whatever it is, my abilities or anything at all, and if they are used by a person who is awake to all the relationships between himself and things and other people and the totality, then there is no evil. You see, this is the crux of the matter. It lies at the very heart of all things. Because through man, the totality is awakening to its own totalness in terms of complete relationships between all the parts that compose it. It is because each of us as individuals is not sufficiently awake to this. The relationships are incomplete, imperfect, or broken. Then we suffer and we cause suffering. Now you remember, either last time or time before, we looked into that little discourse of the Buddhas where the Brahman Kevaddha comes to him and talks, asks various questions. And one of the questions towards the end of that discourse which the Brahman asks is, where do fire, air, earth, water disappear and meet their end? And you remember how the Buddha points out that the question is wrongly worded. Instead of asking where do the elements find their end, the objective elements as such, the question which should be investigated is where do earth, air, fire, water find no footing? Not where the elements disappear, but where do they find no footing? Now the difference in formulation of the question is very important. The elements as such will present themselves to people throughout the world in the way in which people are conscious of them, as separate elements. Solids are solids, liquids are liquids, or as that statement, mountains are mountains, and so forth, you see. They are what they are. But for you and for me, who are concerned with the religious life, it is our own awareness of them, the way in which we are aware of them, is what makes the difference. When I say that I see a wall, what am I actually seeing? Am I seeing that something in its own inward reality, or am I aware of a mental picture which has formed in my mind? You see, in actual fact, and this is not just Eastern philosophy, East and West alike have presented these philosophies. David Hume, for instance, in England. We are well aware now that it is not the actual physical object, whatever it may be, of which we are directly conscious, but of the mental picture that is formed in our minds. That is what we are really conscious of. If that were not the case, everyone would give the same description when he saw, say, a sunset, but he doesn't, and he cannot. The versions given by different people, all of them are different versions. So we are conscious of earth, air, fire, water as pictures in our own mind. And these separate pictures, earth, air, fire, water, and so forth, are the divisive forces in our own consciousness. The mental pictures undergo changes. The object itself doesn't. You take that piano, for instance. All right? One sees a piano and says, there is a piano. One plays upon it, and so forth and so forth. 1 year passes, 10 years pass, 50 years pass. Do you remember the succession of pictures of the piano which you have had through the 50 years? The piano means something quite different. And you actually see it with your eyes differently. That is to say, your mental eyes. Your physical eyes will only register rays of light being reflected from that solid object entering the retina and making an electrical disturbance in your brain. That's the physical part of the story. The mechanism remains unaltered. But the psychical phenomenon, I see that piano, is different every time. For the same person, leave alone for different persons. Now, our attachment, aversion, all our conflicts, all our grasping, all our bondage, all our dukkha, and take dukkha in its original meaning, far from the infinite, the transcendent solid, that is its ultimate meaning, you know. The actual word itself means that. So, the change which has to take place with regard to the elements is in terms of our consciousness. So the question is reformulated by the Buddha. Where do earth, air, fire, water find no footing? Because our consciousness of them is the source of bondage. Our misperception of them. And you remember the answer. Vijnanam anidarsanam anantam sabbato bhavam. Consciousness, infinite, characterless, invisible, That's anidarsanam. Anantam, endless, without birth, without death. Sabbato, everywhere, always. Pabham, one of the other texts uses the word paham. You can take one or the other word. One means accessible, the other means shining. It is there that these elements find no footing. This is the state of nirvana, if you like. Nothing to do with pleasant sensations. Nirvana is not all chocolates and honey. Pleasant sensations bodily will come, unpleasant sensations will come. That is the nature of our existence in that which is compounded of the elements. The body itself is compounded of these elements. It's part of the whole world and the world process. So all that will come. But inwardly there'll be that liberation. It's the psyche that is liberated from its bondage. When psyche finally is united with Eros, which means creative power ultimately, not the ordinary meaning of Eros related to the idea of the erotic. When psyche is in permanent union with Eros, psyche's mortality has transformed and become immortal. So you see, this, the body, composed of the elements, perishes all along the line. But our consciousness undergoes transformation. And this is the meaning of spiritual development. There is no other meaning to it. This is spiritual development. All the rest, which is associated with this transformation of consciousness, that is to say, all the manifestation in terms of conduct, behavior, the way one thinks, feels, and so forth, all that is secondary. This is the root thing. Now, if we understand this, we can understand why they say the source and the goal are the same. Out of that indescribable, absolute, infinite, eternal, the void, which is the plenitude simultaneously. You see? Out of that, one reality, come all these multitudinous items which make up the variety. All in perfect relationship. And when in us our isolated self-consciousness has undergone the transformation, and in our awareness we see and feel all the relationships in a state of one great harmony, then back we are at that primordial source. The light and the darkness are identical then. If all the opposites, all the contraries, resolve into a unity, in which the apparent opposites are wholly and completely subsumed. If that happens, then there is total liberation. Let's go back to that very important point. As and when that happens, there is obviously nothing for me, because there is no I then, no separate I. Entity, particular entity, and the preservation of its identity means separation, means being cut off from the whole. We can talk like this quite easily, we can think like this, we can raise up arguments for and against. Those who are theists, for instance, the majority of theists in the world, whatever religion they belong to, Zarathustrian or Judaic or Christian or Islamic or any, they will assert the separate identity of an immortal soul in the individual. And you can argue about it. You can go on churning up the ocean of thought about it and satisfy yourself that you've proved your point. But beware, truth is other than proving anybody's point or disproving anybody's point. Truth transcends all that nonsense. That is the immature adolescent stage. Necessary. Necessary. Because without it, we cannot grow out of it. We have to go through this in order that, having gone through all the tensions and the conflicts and this, that and the other, we can emerge into the profounder stage. And in that profounder stage, the isolated I, the entity I, has at last vanished into nothing. The awareness, the vijnana, which is infinite, which is endless, immortal, no birth, no death, which is accessible everywhere and shines everywhere, that has no separate particulars in it. We have entered an age in human history where the further development of man necessitates a supreme austerity. Which does not mean a stupid infliction of pain or deprivation on oneself, because that inevitably affects others too, for ill, not for good. I don't mean austerity in that sense. But austerity in this sense, everything which is unnecessary is discarded. This is asceticism in the supreme sense. Not to deprive yourself or others hurtfully. That is stupidity only. But to discard everything unnecessary. Look at great poetry, great music, Not a single unnecessary word. Not a single unnecessary note. Perfection. How is that attained? By discarding the unnecessary. How does a Praxiteles or a Phidias produce the perfect statue? And what marvelous statues those old Greeks produced. How? You take a block and a hammer and a chisel and remove all that is unnecessary. Our task is like that. But here the block is this fellow who is ignorant, incapable, confused, foolish, greedy, ambitious, jealous, frightened, and all these things. His business is to see that, this is the case. Here is fear, here is jealousy, here is anger, here is laziness, and so on and so on and so on. To see all that. And the seeing with a white-hot intensity is the hammer and the chisel which moves away, cuts out all that is unnecessary for the release of the man made in the image of God. This is what it is. This is meditation. This is deep prayer, whichever way you approach it, the way of the devotee or any other way. Whichever way you approach it, as long as we clutter ourselves with preconceptions of an ought to be, of a goal to be attained, we will always fail. Inevitably and absolutely. How can I, the ignorant one, preconceive perfection and set it up as a goal? My conception bears the stamp of all that I actually am. And if I am ignorant and foolish and incapable, how on earth can I set up before me the goal which is perfection and truth? See, the fact is, we don't trust life. We don't trust reality. We don't trust truth. We use these words. And then what happens? Having used the words all the time, we are hankering after, striving for, and expecting results desired by us as we are. It is this sort of I which is completely denuded. You know how all the great mystics, whoever they were, Christian, Hindu, Buddhist, Sufi, anybody, they say that the soul can stand in the presence of God only naked. What does it mean? When one is stripped of everything. Stripped of everything. This is purification. This is the disciplining. And I'm trying to suggest, point out all the subtle difficulties that lie in the way. The tricks that the mind plays, our own thought process plays. This is the great obstructor, our own thought process. Let life live through you. Then one will find real freedom from bondage to the elements. There is a really fascinating section in the Maitri Upanishad. Have you ever looked into it? Into the Maitri Upanishad? It's one of the lesser known ones, but a very remarkable one, like all the great Upanishads, but let me see. These verses deal with liberation. And let me preface it by recalling to your minds, I'm sure some, if not all of you, have come across this. Whatsoever a man thinketh upon, in the Bible you have the phrase, as a man thinketh in his heart, whatsoever a man thinketh upon, that he becomes. Therefore, think upon Brahman, the absolute, the ultimate reality, the Vijnanam Anidarsanam. Now, beware of the words. Can you think upon the infinite? You can say the word infinite. You can't think it. Thinking is picture making, form making in the mind. And all form making for us human beings can only be in terms of the types of forms set up by the functioning of our senses, sights, sounds, tastes, touches, smells. That's all there can be. So, beware of the words. Now, let me read this. As fire of fuel destitute becomes extinct in its own source, so thought by loss of activeness becomes extinct in its own source. Becomes extinct in its own source because the mind seeks the real. For one confused by things of sense, there follow actions false controls. This is very important. Samsara. You all know the meaning of samsara, usually translated as the cycle of births and deaths. Is just one's own thought. Nothing to do with reincarnation as popularly conceived and believed. Nothing at all. It's all in your own mind. From the time we are born till the time we die. Now, the word thought here is rather unfortunate, because in the text, the word used, the original text, the word used is chitta. And chitta is not thought in our English sense of the word. In our sense of the word, thought is just a string of words. Chitta is attention, attentiveness. And attention in itself is formless. It's formless, shapeless. It is not under the constraints of sense functioning. The senses can function. You may be looking in that direction, towards that wall, but you will not be conscious of seeing the wall if your attention is absolutely engaged hundreds of miles away in something else. You're actually attending to something else. If whilst you are looking in the direction of that wall, you were to remember, say, during the last war, some awful bombing or explosion or some terrible event, or whatever it is that you are remembering, you'll be unconscious of the wall. See, so chitta is quite different. Do you get it? It's not the activity of manas merely, the ordinary fluctuations of the mind. The fluctuations of chitta, of attention, are one's own thought. Attention flits from here to here. From this sense functioning and these sense images to those sense images. Attention fluctuates. Certain sense impressions have captured your attention. You are born in that. When those have ceased to hold your attention, you have died to it. Because all self-consciousness is dependent upon your attention. And this is the cycle of births and deaths which is meant by samsara in the original teachings. The Shandilya Upanishad says absolutely unequivocally, when the fluctuations of chitta cease, samsara, the cycle of births and deaths, has come to an end. What has this got to do with the popular belief of reincarnation? Nothing at all. This is the real rebirth. The process in the mind, the process in the deluded consciousness, in bondage to isolative self-consciousness. I am I. Samsara is just one's own thought. With effort, he should cleanse it then. What is one's thought? He is using the word thought. What is one's chitta? That he becomes. This is the mystery. By tranquility of thought, deeds, good and evil, one destroys. Now the word for tranquility here is prasada. Prasada means grace also. Now, if instead of using the English word thought, we use the word attentiveness, attention, by the grace of attention, if there is right attention, if there is right attention, is it ever tainted by greed or hate or delusion, by ambition or jealousy? If there is right and pure attention, then there is the state of perfect communion. And is not that the state of grace? Is not that what we call the divine state? Is not that what we mean by the liberated consciousness? So, by the grace of attention, deeds, karma, good and evil. In the world of the relative, we think in terms of good and evil, the good and evil being fundamentally determined deep in our unconscious by our own pleasure, pain, joy, sorrow, attachment, aversion, reactions. This is the trouble. What is the real good? What is the real evil? And when he says deeds, good and evil, one destroys, it means that one has completely transcended all the limitations of the world of the relative. By the grace of perfect attentiveness. See the importance of mindfulness, of attentiveness. Jesus said, watch and pray. The meaning of watch. If one really appreciates this, one will know the remarkable truth and the remarkable poignancy of his words in Gethsemane, could ye not watch 1 hour with me? See, why can't I watch even 1 hour? In bondage to the elements, my pictures of the elements, tied up with this isolative self-consciousness. That is the usual way they translate, the word is Atma. With Atma serene, stayed, S-T-A-Y-E-D, stayed on the Atma, delight eternal one enjoys. As firmly as the thought of man is fixed within the realm of sense. Now here thought is thought in the ordinary sense. Is fixed within the realm of sense. If thus on Brahman it were fixed, who would not be released from bondage? Our attention is fixed upon the objects of sense, aren't they? It's the objects of sense that captures our attention day and night, all along the line. But if our attention were fixed upon Brahman, the Absolute, then who would not be released from bondage? The mind is said to be twofold. Now in the text the word used is mana. The pure and also the impure. Impure by union with desire. Driven by desire. Pure from desire, completely free. Because desire is personal, separatively personal. Good desires and bad desires alike. That which is perfection just happens by itself. When you go out into your garden and see the rosebud has opened up and is blooming, and you enjoy the delight of the perfume of that rose. Did my desire produce that? This is the life process, that's all. Live it, and it is there. But desire in relation to it, and see all that happens before and when you go into the garden and smell the rose. Notice the difference in your own psyche. The absence of the spontaneity of joy. It doesn't come to you fresh, new. There is an expectation which has been fulfilled. And every expectation which has been fulfilled carries with it the signs and the stench of death. Because there is self, separate self involved in it. That is why don't expect, don't hope just see. Be awake. Be attentive. And let divinity fulfill itself. This is the great thing, and an extremely difficult thing. By making mind all motionless, from sloth and from distraction freed, when unto mindlessness one comes, then that is the supreme estate. Mindlessness means letting the mind be completely open, free, transparent, empty. Mindlessness means not cluttering the mind with all the shapes and forms that we set up in the mind through our desire and all our sorrow-making drives. This is the meaning of it. But it's a very deep and a profound meaning. So long the mind should be confined till in the heart it meets its end. And the heart in this context, hridaya, word used in all mysticism, refers to that aspect of us, that energy and force in us which is transcendence itself. In the symbolism of yoga, the Sahasrara chakra, the crown center, the crown as presented in the Kabbalah, for instance, Kether. That is the heart. This is where transcendence works in us and affects the psychophysical organism all the time. Without compelling it, without trying to persuade it. Of our own free will and accord, we have to grow into it. Till in the heart it meets its end. The rest, from the brain downwards to the base of the spine, all the different chakras, you know, which they talk of in the Hatha Yoga symbolism. It is symbolical, remember, but completely instructive. The rest of the mind, coming up here, finally, meets its end, its freedom, its liberation. To use the terms of the yoga, Shakti, power, meets Shiva, the Lord. And when they are united, there is the utter fulfillment of man. The mind, in truth, is for mankind the means of bondage and release, both. For bondage, if to objects, to the elements, that is, it is bound. From objects free, that's called release. So you see, what a man thinketh in his heart, conscious in the transcendent way, what you are aware of transcendently is what you actually are. Therefore they say, let your attention be always upon the transcendent, the absolute. The Adi Buddha, if you would like to put it in Mahayana terms.